or Donovan's going to cut you. Milena practically staggered backwards, her face stricken and pale.
Why, she stammered, why would you say something like that to me?
What do you mean, I replied, oblivious to what I might have done. I was just making a joke.
I was stabbed a month ago.
Oh, shit. The redness of embarrassment shone through my movie makeup. I am so sorry, I apologized earnestly. I never would have been such a jackass if I knew that. Milena's story was chilling. She had been casually walking through her neighborhood, which was not far from where Ida and I were staying, when she rounded a corner and saw four loitering hooligans.
Give me your purse! Give me your wallet, they demanded.
Screw you, she boldly defied them. I'm not giving you anything. The thugs attacked, but Milena was tough and managed to keep them at bay. Before they scampered away, she felt a sharp pain in her arm. Looking down at the fresh blood pouring out, she knew she had been stabbed. To her amazement, a police officer was directly across the street. He had seen it all unfold and had done nothing to intervene.
What the hell? Milena shouted at the cop crossing the street toward him. They're right there. You saw them.
The cop's expression didn't change as Milena gestured to her injury.
What about this? They stabbed me.
The cop looked at her fresh wound and said, you're a rich girl. You can afford to go to the clinic. In this case, and I have found it true, whenever the police force of a given country is woefully underpaid, the officer gets to make a judgment call instead of enforcing a fixed set of laws. The assailants, in his view, were more contemporaries than anything, and because Milena clearly had more money, she wasn't really a victim. I promised myself that as soon as I got home, I would thank the first police officer I saw. The Rise of Michael Weston. Earlier in the year, while we were in the middle of shooting Burn Notice, Jeffy Donovan sauntered over between setups. My contract issues had been resolved, and it was public knowledge that I was getting a spin-off TV movie. Hey, Donovan said, somewhat sheepishly, which made me immediately suspicious. So I guess I should say congratulations on your TV movie.
Oh, yeah. Thanks, I replied.
Awkward pause. Finally, Donovan broke the silence. So, who's going to direct it?
Oh, you know, we got a handful of guys in mind.
Oh? Like some of the Burn Notice guys? Showrunner Matt Nix and I had assembled a short list of directors who had done impressive work on the series and could handle a larger scale endeavor. Donovan nodded and offered, well, hey, if you wouldn't mind, I sure would love to put my name in the hat.
Oh. Yeah, sure.
I'll mention it to Matt, I replied, being careful not to sound too excited or concerned. Actually, Donovan had directed his first episode of Burn Notice early on in season 4, and we were all really pleased with how it went down. During the shoot, Jeffrey had a completely different vibe. He skipped around set like a little kid and had a great time directing. As an actor, I love directors who actually care about the mechanics of acting. Sometimes you get stuck with folks who don't think twice about character progression or performance. Donovan knew how to talk to actors, and that mattered to me. I fired off an email to Nix. Hey, JD just expressed an interest in directing this thing. What do you think about putting him on the list?
Sure, why not, Nix replied.
So Donovan entered the list at around number 4. At the time, Matt Nix had another show in production called The Good Guys, and a recurring director on that show was a top candidate for helming the fall of Sam Axe. Unfortunately, he did something that ended up on Matt's other list. Donovan was up to number 3. Now, I may not remember this correctly, but rumor had it that the other two candidates became unavailable due to a, quote, series of mysterious accidents shortly after Donovan entered the list. Long story short, due to a freak lead pipe slash kneecap accident and a faulty brake line, Donovan became our one and only choice. The more I thought about it, the more I realized that getting Donovan to direct this was an elegant solution. It was almost a form of paying tribute to the headliner of the show and give him a connection to it. If the fall of Sam Axe was a success, he and I could celebrate together. If it failed, we'd have some more stories to chuckle about. Ultimately, Matt Nix and I were right to put our faith in Donovan.
He directed the fall of Sam Axe with the confidence and skill of a veteran. Having a professional cohort I could trust down in Bogota didn't hurt either.
The prequel diet. When the audience first met Sam Axe in Burn Notice, they met a lounging Lothario, a lager-swilling retiree with love handles and liver damage. He was a character who created an entire lifestyle around the notion of not giving a shit anymore. The beer gut and muscular atrophy were just part of the package. To be the Sam Axe in the fall of Sam Axe, I would have to transform into the, quote, younger, still-on-duty version. I needed to lose at least 15 pounds and regain some degree of muscle tone. The goal in presenting this character as I attempted to turn back the hands of time was not to embarrass myself. To lose the weight, working out wasn't going to be enough. I had to stop ingesting everything that I had ever enjoyed. Booze, meat, oil, sugar, flavor, and happiness. Until I reached my goal. I could have absolutely no fun at all or any of the things that I desired, craved, or enjoyed. I thought all that leading man, overexertion, and sacrifice crap was behind me when Jack of All Trades was canceled. I did successfully drop from around 225 pounds down to 210 in time for production. What was surprising, though, was that the workload caused me to lose an additional 10 pounds over the course of the four-week shoot. When I left Columbia, I was 200 pounds, the allegedly perfect weight according to my height and build. Stepping off the plane in the United States, I immediately stuffed my face with as much meat, oil, sugar, and flavor as I could find, and washed it all down with the finest hooch. That ideal weight lasted about an hour and a half.
Battle Axe.
The fall of Sam Axe was scheduled for a four-week shoot. With 6 days of filming a week, it was an aggressive workload. The upside was that I wouldn't have to endure the smog or stabbings for too long. The downside was that it was the toughest shoot I'd experienced since the 108 days of filming Army of Darkness. I remember sending texts to friends grumbling, "Man, you can take this leading man shit and shove it." Sam Axe was a character whose every other line on Burn Notice was, "Hey, buddy, hand me one of those beers." Now, front and center, Sam was suddenly expected to make impassioned speeches and carry every scene. As the primary focus of the plot, my character had more dialogue than I had seen since my days in the Adventures of Briscoe County, Jr. Despite having access to a portfolio of cheat sheets developed for Burn Notice, I didn't want to go down that road on the fall of Sam Axe. The courtroom scenes had epic amounts of dialogue, and I wanted to be ready. I respected Donovan as a director, and I didn't want to piecemeal our way through the material. Long scenes need to get into a groove to work. Thankfully, we were able to do that. And by wrap time, Donovan and I had established a mutual record, shooting 17 pages in one day. The fall of Sam Axe was born out of an internal corporate conflict. But despite all the hassles, negotiations, business affairs, disputes, and obstacles, I'm happy to report that the spinoff was a success. If this TV movie had been an actual pilot, the ratings and reviews would have merited its own episodic series. Happy endings are always the best kind.
The Turn of the Burn.
As always, TV ratings run their course. Burn Notice started strong, jumping to the head of the cable TV pack and staying there for roughly four of its seven seasons. The USA Network was a great partner at the right time, and they treated us like the network tentpole that we were. Eventually, whether it was viewer fatigue, an increasingly serious and complicated storyline, or USA's repetitive, quote, blue sky TV show model, viewers began to tune out. I got better insight, anecdotally, a year or so after the show ended, when folks would ask, "That ran for six seasons, right?" After correcting them that it was in fact seven, I realized that some people thought Burn Notice ran for as many seasons as they watched. After committing to seasons 5 and 6 concurrently, which was a thrilling vote of confidence, USA decided that season 7 would be our last. Mercifully, because everyone was warned in advance, we could all prepare for the end. The story could be wrapped up cleanly, and production could plan ahead for the big shutdown. It's a big deal getting rid of 7 years of accumulated sets, props, destroyed vehicles, and racks of wardrobe that range from pimp outfits to SWAT gear.
Bob, the head of production for Fox, let us know that we could get first dibs on our wardrobe. Hey, 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 but not for free. Fox was running a business, and studios are not known for their sentimentality. Basically, everything that could be sold off was, from the bar stools in Carlito's restaurant to Michael Weston's trusty charger. For my part, I took first dibs on the best Hawaiian shirts, because, you know, patterns matter. Some sunglasses, watches, Sam Axe's jewelry, and the most prized possession of all. It's a prop spiral binder that contained roughly 5 years of, quote, in-scene note-taking. It was fun to flip through after the fact and review all the diagrams, random notes, and actual lines of dialogue scribbled within. All in all, Burn Notice had a great run. 7 years on television is nothing to sneeze at. Ultimately, we shot 111 episodes, exactly the same as Miami Vice, the first iconic show to put Miami on the map. Chapter 17, Afterburn. When Burn Notice ended in 2013, Ida and I rented a place in L.A. It was time to find a new gig. We hadn't lived in Southern California for almost 20 years, so it was exciting to reconnect with old friends and business acquaintances and see what opportunities lay ahead. When you live outside of Los Angeles, you can drop in for extended meetings and a few follow-ups, but it's hard to keep things moving week after week to get a project in gear, like you can do when you actually live in the city. After being back in Los Angeles for about 6 months with dozens of exciting meetings and business opportunities, I began to realize a bit of what I had left behind, the wheeling and dealing, and I missed it. Bullshitting with producers and networks can get tiresome after a while, but in just a couple of focused weeks in the same city as dozens of production entities, it's amazing what can happen. The following is a smattering of projects that unfolded, or didn't, immediately after Burn Notice. Last Call. With the completion of Burn Notice, I wasn't interested in, quote, working for the man. I wanted to, quote, be the man and have my own show. The opportunity arose when Jeff Wachtel from the USA Network collared me at a promotional event. "Let's take a walk," he said with an inscrutable smile. Jeff explained that he had a show in mind, a fun, late-night, genre-centric show where you view a culty, kitschy movie and do skits during the breaks with funny guests. The name they had was Nightcap. I was all over it like a cheap suit. In my formative years, I religiously watched local Detroit goofball Ron Swede, a.k.a. The Ghoul, host a late-night show on Saturdays that was very similar in concept. Another local wacko was Sir Graves Gasly. His show was during the day on Saturdays, so I definitely had early influencers in that department. I had always wanted to host something, but in reality, it's a bit of an odd gig. Part of it falls on your shoulders to be accessible, charming, able to think fast. The other part, like acting, is scripted, and you're often reading off a teleprompter. A host saying, "We'll be right back after this," is indicative of the structure of almost anything on television, due to the necessity of commercial interruptions. Skits within a late-night show can be ad-libby and freewheeling, but they're still timed and trimmed for length, and as witty as a host may be, his or her show is still well-plotted. A pilot episode for Nightcap was written by Brad Stevens and Boyd Vico. We called them Brad and Boyd. I thought the end product, taped very quickly and painlessly, was very sellable, while knowing that there was always room for improvement. USA ended up rejecting it for their late night, or any slot. Thankfully, NBC Universal, the parent company of USA, had a large collection of networks under their corporate umbrella, so we pitched Nightcap to them all, including the newly renamed Sci-Fi Channel. Still, no takers. We pitched the show, quote, beyond the corporate veil, to anyone who would watch it. But like many pilots before it, Nightcap found no suitors. I was surprised and bummed that we laid an egg. I figured the idea was light and funny enough to find a home. Failure is never thrilling to experience, but Nightcap remains a happy memory because at least I got a little host practice out of the deal. Bad Session. Now that I was living in the actual city of Los Angeles, I could follow up on opportunities much more quickly than when I was hiding in the boonies of Oregon. It was also a funny thing with my representatives. I suddenly became more real to them, more tangible. I could take actual meetings. Whatever the case, it seemed to make a difference and things continued to line up. Next on the hit parade was a TV pilot called Good Session, starring James Rhode from Psych. I got on his radar guest starring on his long-running show, and he tapped me to play his hippy-dippy father in this dramedy about a young couple in therapy. A table read is a funny thing. It happens before you shoot a given show, and it can be a nervous affair because all the mucky mucks are present, as well as a sea of flunkies and assistants to provide the sometimes needed laughter. A good table read crackles with energy, and the room beams with possibility. The read-through for Good Session did not crackle. It just kind of sat there. In this case, it was hard to place the blame. The actors were all trying hard, the writing seemed okay, but the magic somehow passed them by. After a good read, participants will all often linger about, congratulating one another and making small talk. After this one, the room emptied like someone ripped a nasty fart. The pilot episode was shot without incident. It was fun to step back into the wacky supporting mode type acting after headlining Nightcap. The fate of a project lingers as long as a studio or network needs it to. Legitimately, some networks need to wait for a slot in their lineup to open, and they'd rather wait until the last minute, contractually, to decide on a show. Good Session suffered no such long, dreary waiting period. The decision to not take the show to series came just a couple weeks after shooting. Wow, that was fast. Okay, next. Mission out of control. Because Good Session never got past the pilot, I did what every other actor does that time of year. Jump from project to project, hoping to land in a show that sticks. I was convinced that Mission Control would be that show. This particular TV pilot was the brainchild of Will Ferrell's company, Gary Sanchez Productions, a creative nut I wanted to crack for a while. I was a huge fan of Will and the stuff coming out of Funny or Die, so I jumped at the chance to play Bob Corman, idiot administrator of a band of misfits in the middle of the NASA space race. Conceptually, it was basically Mad Men with jokes. I love the 60s time period. Close-cropped hair, skinny ties, the chauvinistic bravado of the guys, and the coifs of the women's hair. Some time periods suck for an actor. I never dug the sword and sandal stuff or World War I wool uniforms, but the 60s were cool. Pipes and Zippo lighters and dial telephones heavy enough to kill someone were bizarre reminders of distant childhood memories. I still love going to the back lots of major studios. It never gets old. Going to the Edith Head building, named after one of the great costume designers of the Golden Era, on the Universal lot for a costume fitting was awesome, because they made a custom 60s jacket that fit me to a T. Call me snooty, but every so often it's really nice to work on something with a budget. The main set constructed was an almost as big Mission Control, duplicated with great detail, including overflowing ashtrays at every console. The cast and assembly of young, talented comedians really gave me hope that this show was going to, quote, go. I also really appreciated how these guys worked creatively. Don Scardino was the director. We worked together on a pilot called Missing Links about 15 years before, and he had since become one of the go-to guys for directing comedy pilots. His style was light and breezy, and he kept our energy up. The cool thing would be that after virtually every take, Don and the writers would come in and pitch completely new material. I like things fast and loose where you collectively look for the best way to play out a scene, especially if you want it to have punch or be funny. I enjoyed going to work every day on that. I envisioned years and years of working with this talented ensemble and basically laughing our asses off. No such luck. After a bit of recasting, the pilot came to a halt and then sat on the shelf for the better part of a year while Universal tried to find a slot for it. Eventually, time expired and the network had to shit or get off the pot. Farewell, Mission Control. I hope the pilot leaks somewhere so people can actually see it. Every actor I know has a dozen of these strange projects under their belt that nobody will ever see. Some of it really good stuff that just didn't catch on for whatever reason. Loose Bruce. Operation Gainful Employment continued with a little indie called The Escort. I was enjoying just being an actor for hire again. Living in Los Angeles, you are way more likely to do small projects just because you're already there. Living on an Oregon mountaintop, I might as well have said, nah, thanks, too much hassle to haul my carcass down there for some little bit.
Indies are fun, but it usually means that the budgets are low and the personnel are less experienced. As an actor, you have to put that all aside and participate because the role is good. Again, playing a hippy-dippy father, maybe the feature on me in High Times had an influence on casting, I enjoyed the efforts of its star, Michael Doniger, who was also producing. I always respect when actors get fully behind what they're doing. More and more are producing these days, and it makes total sense. If you want control, you need to be a producer, and you need to be good at finding money. Like so many flicks these days, The Escort dropped on pay-per-view and video on demand, or VOD. The film business is adopting a whole slew of new terms for distribution in the digital age. Presumably the film did okay for what it cost. No harm, no foul. On to the next adventure.
Game off. I had agreed to host a charity game show for troops at the Sam Houston base in San Antonio, Texas. I hate war to the core of my being, but I have no issue with the soldier willing to put it all on the line. For some reason, I didn't want to go. I was tired. I wanted to kick back and do nothing after a busy year or so, but a commitment is a commitment. So I donned the silliest red, white, and blue outfit I could find and hosted Quest for the Best, a military-themed trivia game show where everyone in the audience gets to compete until one soldier wins it all. The theater where this event took place was beautiful, a fully restored 30s-era showplace seating 600. It was fun performing in front of soldiers who were mandated to be in attendance. They had to be there. Nothing like a captive audience. The game and its design unfolded really well, and the soldiers were getting quite verbally engaged as the game went on, down to the last four contestants. In a real nail-biting fight to the finish, the soldiers erupted in joy when the final contestant, a woman, took the prize. This format works, I told myself. This sucker could be adapted to be done live at conventions. Just make it all fan-based pop culture trivia, like a game show for geeks. I pitched the idea of Last Fan Standing, the new name, to Steve Sellery, the developer of the game, and he bit right away. I then pitched it to Johnny Macaluso, the CEO of Wizard World Entertainment, one of the biggest convention promoters, whom I was doing a lot of business with, and he jumped on board. Eventually, the show wound up in the hands of ConTV, an internet-based network that specialized in movies and TV shows for genre fans. On paper, it all sounded great, and we made a preliminary deal. The only problem is that ConTV was in no position to finance the actual 10 episodes they just negotiated to get. So myself and three other partners formed a company and put up the money. That was a neat trick. Get the people who make the show to pay for it, too. What a great business model. The 10 episodes of Last Fan Standing were filmed live at a couple different conventions, and it was a lot of fun. Staging shows at an actual convention, packed to the gills with geeks, made for great contestants. As the episodes played out, there were dramatic upsets, come-from-behind wins, total humiliation, the whole gamut of emotions on display. Generally speaking, the format worked and seemed worth the effort. To this day, I couldn't tell you what the ratings were for Last Fan Standing. Honestly, I wonder if ConTV even knew. Gone are the Nielsen boxes of the old days. Now we're counting clicks or subscriptions or hits. I hope they figure it all out one day. Needless to say, ConTV and Last Fan Standing had reached the end of the line. It's actually fine because it freed Steve and me to take the game to various cities and do it live, which is always the most fun anyway. Kicking the bucket. As an actor, you want to touch all the bases. Drama, comedy, action, genre, musicals. Okay, maybe not those. You want to do it all, and you want to pepper your resume with as many portrayals of iconic characters as you can. I mean, what else is the point of being an actor? I was contacted by my Burn Notice alumni, Mark Roskin and Jonathan Frakes, about coming up to Portland to play Santa Claus in the new show, The Librarians. Every actor has a bucket list. Santa Claus was on mine. And how nice to actually work in the state where I live. Where do I sign? Even if Christmas isn't your bag, everyone has heard of Santa Claus. He's a worldwide phenomenon. What was nice about this particular Santa was that the writers spun him to be a little edgy, sometimes naughty, but a hero in the end. Portland, Oregon is one of my favorite cities on the planet. It's big enough to provide anything you're looking for, but small enough to give a shit. The town is run by local soul patch wearing 20-somethings who don't really care what they do for a living. In Los Angeles, bartenders can be a snotty, self-important bunch, but in Portland, they dig the craft cocktails and really get into the history of adult beverages. I back that approach to life. Jonathan Frakes, directing this episode, was one of our favorites on Burn Notice. We can only get him for one or two episodes a year because Miami got too hot for him. Pussy. Frakey Pants, as I came to call him, was always a delight to work with. Some directors don't get it. Some don't know how to talk to actors. Frakes was an actor, so he knew all of our foibles and our tricks and could see trouble coming. Some directors get buried under workload. The joke on set about such directors is Gone with the Wind in the morning, Dukes of Hazzard after lunch, meaning that they got a little too self-important out of the gate and fell behind during the course of the day. Television is a train that needs to run on time. Frakes was a brilliant conductor. He was very happy to print a first take or a partial take and move on to the next. He never simmered or doubted. He just plodded ahead. In television, that's exactly the temperament you need. The cast of The Librarians made shooting a delight. Rebecca Rahman was a great leading lady. Funny, professional, and striking. The rest of the actors rounded out by the great John Larroquette were eager and fresh. You want to work on a TV show early on because it's still a fun voyage of discovery. Old TV shows can devolve into plotting, humorless affairs like my guest star experience on the last season of The X-Files, where it felt like the entire company would rather have been anywhere else. Once I crossed Santa Claus off my actor bucket list, another work call came in, this time from longtime friend and collaborator John Cameron, whom I've known since high school. Beginning as an assistant director, John soon found himself running major movie sets, including Men in Black and The Hudsucker Proxy. He began producing with the Coen brothers shortly thereafter, and I wound up with cameos in Lady Killers and Intolerable Cruelty, so we kept bumping into each other. John's most recent gig was producing the Coens' adaptation of Fargo for FX, and the first season had taken off critically. For his efforts, John walked away with both an Emmy and a Golden Globe. I got a kick out of going over to his house and making a big deal out of it in front of his seemingly unimpressed teenage kids. "Come up to Calgary and play Ronald Reagan," John said over the phone. Knowing full well that we had both imitated Reagan mercilessly during his stint as president, John felt confident that I could fake an imitation. But the trick was to make him a full-blown character, not an SNL sketch. In anticipation of joining this highly regarded show, with a first-class writer in Noah Hawley and Emmys in its wake, I got nervous, so I wasn't going to take any chances. A local rehearsal space in Hollywood is known as the Complex. This jumble of a half-dozen mini-theaters and rehearsal rooms is my favorite place to prep. Each of the small spaces has a different name and feel. They come with sparse furnishings, lighting, and a bare stage with about 20 seats in miniature auditoriums. Whenever I go there, I feel like a real actor, with zero distractions. I dragged my filmmaking buddy Mike Callio along to shoot a demo of Reagan giving a speech in the opening of the episode. I wanted to show John and Noah what I was going to do before I got in front of their Emmy-winning cameras. That way, if we wanted to make adjustments or freak out and recast, they had the time to do it. Fortunately, their response was positive, so I went up to Calgary, and my bucket list got a lot smaller.
Chapter 18, Hollywood in Pontiac.
Even though I was born and raised in Michigan, I only worked on a handful of movies there. The original Evil Dead was filmed in Tennessee, because we were trying to avoid a brutal Midwest winter. Our second film, The Disastrous Crime Wave, was shot all over the city of Detroit, but trying to make a movie in the dead of winter left a very unpleasant taste in our mouths. The next film I produced in Michigan was Lunatics, A Love Story. The suburban town of Pontiac was selected mostly because it was a tiny, more manageable version of Detroit, with plenty of funky old buildings. A large, recently abandoned middle school became our base of operations. To give you some background, Pontiac was an automotive powerhouse in its post-World War II heyday, kicking out cars and even buses for decades before the industry took its business elsewhere. A one-horse town, Pontiac, and a lot of other towns like it in Michigan, never fully recovered. For as long as I've known it, Pontiac was always a sketchy place. As we were filming on the streets of Pontiac, the local police were very helpful keeping curious types at bay. My favorite character strolled by late one night, wearing a gloriously ratty tuxedo. "Hollywood and Pontiac," he bellowed. "We got white stars, black stars, polka dot stars." The only other recent experience I had with Pontiac was being rousted by their law enforcement officers on a bike path. Apparently some nervous Nelly called in about two people, quote, waving pistols around. Mind you, riding around on bicycles, Ida and I didn't exactly look like Bonnie and Clyde. Ida was sporting a white Burberry trench coat, and I looked like a model out of an Eddie Bauer catalog. And this wasn't some dark alley or mean street. This was a bikes-only bucolic path on a beautiful Michigan fall day. As we rode, we could see a police car block an intersection coming up in front of us, with two anxious officers leaping out. "I thought the guy had to take a leak," Ida later recalled. We looked behind us, and another police car had pulled in to block our retreat. "Looks like they're after someone," I said, not overly concerned. We thought we were caught in the middle of something else going down. The cop in front of us, gun drawn, approached with purpose, shouting with great authority, "Put your kickstands down and put your hands in the air." I looked at Ida, incredulous. "Holy shit, he's talking to us." We complied with his demands and got a quick, unsympathetic pat-down for our efforts. Thankfully, Pontiac was not in any immediate danger. Neither of us was, in fact, armed, and we were allowed to go along our merry way. Jesus Christ. After that alarming incident, I had no desire to return to Pontiac ever again. Imagine my surprise and delight to learn that the prequel to The Wizard of Oz, one of the most endearing and enduring classics of American cinema, was going to be filmed, not in Los Angeles or New York or Toronto or New Zealand or even Bulgaria, but Pontiac, Michigan. Ironically, the choice made sense. Penny-pinching production practices had sent film and TV projects to Canada and Eastern Europe for decades. To stay relevant, states began implementing their own incentive-slash-rebate programs to entice producers back stateside. And it worked. Michigan knew how important it was to fight the flight of domestic industries. So they jumped into the incentives program with a vengeance and started subsidizing Hollywood movies. I was living out west by this time, and started hearing stories about Robert De Niro, Clint Eastwood, and Drew Barrymore shooting in Michigan. It seemed like everyone was working back in my home state. The truth was, Michigan's incentives were among the best around. A production could expect to get a refund of almost 40% of the money spent in the state. When a certain Disney movie had an estimated budget of well north of $200 million, it's easy to see how incentivized both state and studio would be to work together. Winky Gatekeeper. Most of the guys who made Super 8 movies with me in high school went on to become professionals in film, television, writing, and photography. I've known guys such as the Raimi brothers, Rob Tappert, Josh Becker, Scott Spiegel, Mike Ditz, and John Cameron for most of my adult life. But we don't exactly text each other every time some new project falls in our laps. I don't always know what the boys are up to, and I don't tend to read the trade magazines such as The Hollywood Reporter or Variety. I actually heard about Sam doing Oz from a friend of a friend of a friend. It was bizarre to imagine that Sam was chosen by Disney to revisit such a classic. The original Wizard of Oz was truly an icon of filmmaking, with some of the most recognizable imagery in cinematic history. When you look at Sam's early work, it's easy to appreciate him as a horror director, but let's not forget he also directed a stylish Western, the wonderfully restrained A Simple Plan, and the Spider-Man movies, the first three anyway, proving that what defined him most was a varied, fanciful, visual style. Oz was bound to be a playground of eye candy and visual quirks, so Sam was perfect for the job. In order to be involved, I knew that I had to hound Sam relentlessly. The irony of working on a successful multi-season TV series was that people tend to think you're unavailable. "Sam, come on," I implored. "There's got to be like 7,000 roles. Just give me a little one." "All right, buddy, yeah. Yeah, I'll think about it," he replied, placating me for the time being. I knew the second Sam hung up, he wouldn't remember talking to me. That's how he gets when he's waist-deep in a big project, and this was the biggest of them all. To keep the pressure on, I dusted off my agent's number and urged him to track the lumbering project. Eventually, Sam tossed me the nebulous role of a Winky, one of the numerous big, mean, ugly guys who guard the castle. I felt special that Sam included me, but in retrospect, I can't feel that special. It turned out that Sam gave virtually everyone he ever met in Michigan a part in the film. Next time you're bored or stoned, cross-reference the entire end credits of Oz the Great and Powerful with the 1976 Groves High School yearbook, and you'll see what I'm talking about.
Oz, the slow and powerless.
The timing was perfect. Burn notice was over for the season, and I had some time to kill. My mom, brothers, and some old friends still lived in Michigan, so I decided to rent a place there for a month. I'm glad I did, because various production delays kept me on hold and threatened to scrap my pivotal scene entirely. Oz was the biggest budget project I had ever been a part of. A gigantic former bus manufacturing facility was completely refurbished to the tune of a couple $100 million into a state-of-the-art Hollywood studio, now the largest such space between New York and Los Angeles. I've seen big, sprawling sets before. Hell, for Army of Darkness, we built the castle. But the sets for Oz were unique in that they were only partially built. In the modern world of digital compositing, you didn't need ceilings or a second story anymore. Mr. Digital took it from there. So while a castle entrance would boast an impressive sweeping staircase, you wouldn't see where it leads until the movie was almost finished. A production schedule is a color-coded calendar of interiors, exteriors, location days, and studio time. This schedule has to factor in actor availability, budget restrictions, unpredictable weather, and a slew of other external factors. It is by no means etched in stone, but much effort is made to never let it get out of control. Oz was a big movie with a big, complicated schedule. Therefore, when it had problems, they were big. My little cog, a two-day part, was caught somewhere in that big wheel. So when I was told that my first shooting day had been pushed back, I didn't think anything of it. No big deal. Part of the process. The second time my scene got delayed, I thought, okay, well, Sam's doing some complicated stuff, and it's taking more time than they thought. When I got the third call, I knew something unforeseen was causing a big speed bump in the schedule. It wasn't an actor problem, rehab, or injury. It was just the scope, size, and difficulty of the undertaking, squeezed through a Sam Raimi kaleidoscope. My Name is Bruce was shot in the newish HD format, which resulted in what I call HD-lay. Oz was being shot in 3D with state-of-the-art cameras. I can only imagine the complications of 3D-lay. I was beginning to get a nagging feeling that my silly little scene was going to get the axe. It wasn't a particularly crucial scene. It wasn't launching the story by leading a doomed expedition through the jungle or helping reveal a major plot twist by standing next to Billy Bob Thornton. No, I was expendable. Then the phone rang.
Bruce, Sam wants to talk to you, said the ominous, familiar voice of a Raimi assistant.
Getting Sam on the phone was a rare feat, since he only came up for air for a few minutes at a time between camera setups.
Hey, buddy, Sam said. I got good news and bad news.
Okay, I replied guardedly. Shoot.
The good news is we're going to pay you.
Oh, that is good news.
The bad news is we're cutting your scene.
Oh, that is bad news. For Oz, I was officially contracted and scheduled. I had already gone through a couple wardrobe fittings and an effects makeup session. I knew Sam must have been deep in the weeds to pull the plug after all this. No worries, pal, I consoled him. You got bigger problems.
Francophile.
Being cut from the biggest budget movie to ever film in my home state by one of my oldest friends was deflating, but then the phone rang again. This time, it was James Franco, the star of Oz. For some inexplicable, strange reason, he had enough spare time during the production to star in a student film for an NYU class he was teaching called Tar.
Bruce, he offered, since you're available now, would you be willing to do a gas station scene with me and Goody before you leave town?
Goody? That's right, David Goodman,
the, quote, filmmaker's burden and fellow man with the screaming brain survivor. Incomprehensibly, Sam had picked Goodman, a chronically lousy driver, to shuttle around James Franco, the star of his massive budget blockbuster. Despite Goody's piss-poor driving skills, Franco had become pretty enamored with him. The filmmaker's burden is a very funny guy, and the fact that he's so easily tormented is one of his more likable quirks. I told Franco, I'll do the scene on one condition. What is it? Goody has to drive me to set. In the spirit of good-natured sacrifice, Franco conceded and loaned me his affable, if distracted, chauffeur for the day. When an obscenely large Cadillac Escalade pulled up to my rental house the morning of the shoot, I sauntered to the rear passenger door, opened it, and smiled. Goddamn right, Goodman. Shut up and get in the fucking car, was the surly response. As we drove through Detroit, Goody and I discussed the history of our troubled home city. Franco's film was set in the 70s, and our scene was all about two guys complaining. Goody and I knew the time period and what the residents would complain about, which was mostly the mayor, hockey, and whatever those jerks were doing to Telegraph Road. Franco gave us a carte blanche to ad-lib in the scene, so Goody and I maxed out. After half a day of filming us bullshitting, Franco pleaded, guys, you have to shut up at some point. I have to get my lines in there somewhere. After a fun, low-key day of shooting, Franco cracked a crooked grin. Sam may have cut you from his movie, but I didn't cut you from mine. We shared a knowing laugh, but I suspected that Mr. Franco was up to something. By this point, I had relocated to a hotel near the Detroit Metropolitan Airport in anticipation of an early flight out of Michigan. At 10:30 that night, the phone rang. Caller ID pegged it as Sam's number. I assumed that Sam either had butt-dialed me, thought he was calling Nev Campbell, or was just taking a moment to say, "Happy trails, dear old friend." However, the voice on the other end was Bob Murawski, Sam's editor. Bob, to put him in historical context, also edited Army of Darkness and the Spider-Man trilogy. Pause. Oh, yeah, he also won an Academy Award for editing The Hurt Locker. Affectionately, he's known among us as Bob the Butcher. "You know what?" Bob declared. "You got to be in this movie. I don't know why they cut you out. What the hell's the problem? Why don't you just, you got to be in it." "Bob," I replied, "I'm not the guy to make that decision. Talk to your pal Sam. I got a flight tomorrow at 8. That's all I know." "This is bullshit," Bob barked. "We got to change this. We got to just make it one scene. Just shoot one day." "Bob, it's a decision above my pay grade." "Okay, fine. Bye." Click. Moments later, my phone rang again, and this time it was actually Sam. "Yeah, listen, pal, we thought about it," he explained. "I don't know. You know, it's a good idea. Maybe we'll try and do something. Anyway, see you. Bye." Click. Contrary to popular belief, I'm an old man, and 10:30 p.m. was past my bedtime. I was getting both drowsy and weary of these interruptions. Again, the phone rang, again showing Sam Raimi, but this time James Franco was on the other end. My mind was racing. Did my breakout ad-lib-fueled performance in his NYU experimental film cause him to need me in his huge, albeit largely existential film? Let's go with yes. "You know what?" he declared. "This is bullshit. We're shooting that scene on Monday. James, I'm supposed to get on a plane tomorrow at 8 a.m. Am I getting on that plane, yes or no?" "No." "Are you standing next to Sam?" "Yeah." "Ask him if I'm getting on the plane." On the other end, I could hear their muffled ramblings. "No. No, you're not getting on that plane," Franco finally announced. "We're shooting it on Monday." "Okay. Are you sure?" I could hear loud music, probably Brick House or Macarena in the background, and had little confidence that any conversation would be remembered in the morning. "You're sure this is happening?" "Yeah, you know, I'm shit." Click. I transferred to a different hotel and waited for the truncated version of my clearly expendable scene. It was now going to be one shooting day, a long Sam Raimi shooting day. That meant in addition to the prosthetic makeup process and my time in front of the camera, I could also expect to get both physically and psychologically abused for the director's amusement. In the magical land of Oz, it's not enough to be merely humanoid. Featured characters were given crazy noses, ears, eyebrows, and hairstyles to establish the fanciful universe on the other side of the tornado. My role as the winky gatekeeper required enough effects makeup that I was glad my 2 days had been cut down to one. The makeup team was composed of Sam Raimi veterans, including Greg Nicotero, Robert Kurtzman and Howard Berger. As the K, N, and B of KNB effects, they had been collectively applying toxic substances to my face since Evil Dead 2. Howard had since won an Academy Award for his work on The Lion, The Witch, and The Wardrobe, and was my official makeup homie. I looked around their giant facility. Rows of makeup stations stretched across the room. How many shims come through here every day, I asked. On average, about 90. Christ, each with a fake nose or a bald wig or facial hair? Or all three, Howard said, nonplussed. He had seen a lot since Evil Dead 2. In addition to the prosthetic nose, eyebrows, handlebar mustache, and chin extension, I was outfitted with a 40-pound Cossack jacket. Not much exaggeration there. An 18-inch tall hat and 8-inch boots straight out of a Kiss concert. I wasn't on set for long before Sam and I fell back into the same old routine. He prodded, goaded, and insulted me in front of his now massive crew. He even made sure to yell at me when somebody else made a mistake. The fun was tossing back an insult, just as loud as his, like, "Sorry, Sam, I was waiting for some direction." After this zinger, the gasp among the crew was audible. This day player had insulted the grand poobah. It was only when Sam laughed heartily that they assumed we were old pals. Not surprisingly, Sam also delighted in tormenting James Franco. "That just means he likes you," I explained to James. It was all Sam's special treat for the crew, a show for the folks making the show. Half of the material in my scene was improvised on the fly by Sam, James, myself, and Tony Cox, some of which involved a random fly that would land on each of our faces to different effect. I thought it was really funny, but this sort of unrehearsed nonsense drives visual effects guys crazy. There were something like 1,500 effect shots in the movie, and each one needed to function in 3D. Video Village is where the director, script supervisor, and key camera technicians watch a scene unfold in front of one or two HD monitors. It's like watching television, only you determine the content. The Oz Video Village, being both 3D and very effects-laden, needed three different main monitors. One for seeing what the camera sees, a second for pre-compositing the foreground action with what will digitally become the elaborate background scenery. That kind of technology, where you could meld the live with the animated, blew my mind. The third monitor was fuzzy for some reason. "Put the glasses on," advised a nearby script supervisor. "Oh, okay," I agreed, putting them on. "Ah, oh, it's coming right at me. Oh, that's right. It's 3D. It was almost ridiculous how well the 3D effect worked in real time. The on-set camera, with coaxial cable tentacles spreading out everywhere, actually utilized two lenses to create the stereoscopic result. The complicated rig looked like something on loan from NASA. Seeing Sam next to that extraterrestrial camera made me think back to the days of him strapping a camera to his hand to get a desired visual effect. Still, shooting Oz was a very intimate experience. Sam was the hometown hero, a big-shot Hollywood director with millions and millions of dollars at his disposal, but he was still just an old friend poking me with sticks. I was glad to see that some things never change. Chapter 19, Hardly Functional. Thanks to Mom, I've always loved the American West and Western movies. She dragged me to the last of the John Wayne movies when I was a kid and instilled a sense of awe in the West, like it was a mythical place. For those of you who have actually been to the West, it is a mythical, sometimes mystical place. All the superlatives and cliches apply. Thundering rivers, soaring mountains, sweeping, inhospitable deserts. The American West has it all. So when I got the word about a new project to be filmed in New Mexico, I might have been more excited for my mother than myself. In truth, Tom Dibble's screenplay for Highly Functional was right up my alley. The character Chili Youngfield, a cynical, over-the-hill country singer, was pretty much written for me, aside from the singing and guitar playing part. I flamed out playing drums for McHale's Navy and faced rejection by an Elvis impersonator for Bubba Hotep, so my self-confidence in mastering two new artistic skills at the same time was minimal. I was interested in the part, as long as I didn't actually have to sing or play. I met with director Mark Forby, and we agreed that if necessary, the country-western part could be faked, so we would instead focus on the story, which was wonderfully eclectic. In it, a country western singer is kidnapped by a young man with Asperger's syndrome, nicely played by James Freshfill, and forced to play a song for his dying caretaker, Dan, a song that is loathed by the singer as his only hit, yet it's also the only song in his repertoire that he didn't write. Aside from quirkiness, there were elements in the screenplay that very much appealed to me, namely the redemption of a character after enduring a trial by fire. Before we got any further along in pre-production, I wanted to offer up whatever I could do vocally so the producers would know which way to go. If my singing sucked, they had time to pre-record somebody else, and I would lip-sync to their track. If my vocals were usable, they would know that going in, and I could sing to a playback of myself, which would be delightful, but either way was okay by me. I enlisted trusted Evil Dead composer Joe LaDuca to help with a demo. Joe had relocated to Los Angeles recently and was keen to jot down some country words and help me record one song. I got a taste of modern musical recording methods in the process, which is really an art form now. Old-time singers were recorded with the full band or orchestra, and they would do the entire take without stopping, because there was no editing available. Singers had to get it right, and often. Today, almost any hack can go into a studio with a competent engineer and bluff their way through a song, syllable by syllable if necessary. In my case, I started by laying down a couple of wobbly takes. Joe then worked with the engineer to fix or repair any glitches, false starts, or off-tempo singing. Once they were satisfied with the Frankensteinish assembly, I then watched in both glee and horror as they changed the pitch of my voice to put me on key. This career-saving-slash-making program would literally bend my notes up or down until they were where they needed to be, and voila, I was a country singer. There are no Grammys in my future, but the demo was enough to convince both Mark and Nigel, the producer, to record the songs with my voice. So I happily laid down new tracks with the actual lyrics, written by composer Christopher Bangs. Knowing that I had to at least look like I could play the guitar, I was paired with singer-songwriter Dave Bernal to guide me through the process. Dave was a great teacher with a mediocre student, and I clunked my way through chord progressions for weeks. When I think of a guy playing guitar, I see images of a slightly scruffy dude in torn jeans sitting cross-legged, singing Jim Croce songs to all the pretty girls. I was never that guy. I was never musically inclined. The only accessory I took on location was a briefcase because it was practical. Accepting this fact, I announced to all creative types that they should not plan on me playing for real, and we ended up with a hybrid situation, real singing combined with fake playing. Back during my adventures of Briscoe County Junior days, I started to listen to country music for the first time. Among the annoying patriotic rambles or liquor-soaked bemoaning, country is a great genre for singer-songwriters to tell a story. I wasn't a Garth Brooks or Shania Twain country guy. They were too mainstream to catch my attention. I started to listen to old-timers like Hank Williams and Conway Twitty. George No Show Jones became a favorite of mine, as much for his colorful lifestyle off mic as his rich, authentic singing style. He got the no-show name for his propensity to get too drunk to perform. An early hit, White Lightning, a song about moonshine, had to be recorded over 50 times because he was so wasted. George had a great look, which I adopted. Long, mutton-chop sideburns, which almost reached his jawline. I combined George's facial hair with Glenn Campbell's standard wardrobe of jeans, vest, and a tied neck scarf, and I was almost there. A trip to my local western wear store in Van Nuys, California, finished me off with a sharp hat, a couple pair of boots, and a fat-ass belt buckle. I had the country western thing under control. Now it was time to dive into the acting thing. I retreated with buddy Mike Callio to the complex, my favorite rehearsal space, and we worked the shit out of the lines. This was a fat role. Chili had a lot of colorful dialogue that was really well written. Admittedly, I have shown contempt to lazy writers in the past by butchering their precious words, but I felt like I owed it to the good writing to get it right. Learning lines thoroughly isn't just an admirable acting discipline. It's also the first line of defense against inexperienced or indecisive directors. Be sharp on every take, every angle, and you'll be okay if you have to go on autopilot with no input or poor input. Mark Forby was new to the directing game, but not to producing, and he was very sympathetic to the material. This was an important project to him, so we were both on the same page. The prospect of shooting a movie in the West again was exciting. The last time for me was in Utah for Sundown, A Vampire in Retreat, back in 1988, and it fueled my love of wide-open spaces. I had passed through New Mexico on road trips a couple times, but never stayed to experience the Navajo lands there. Gallup, New Mexico was a weird place, a crossroads in the middle of nowhere. Route 66 went through the middle of town, and it was founded as a railhead for the Atlantic and Pacific Railroad. Like so many new towns out west, Gallup was named after a railroad official, in this case, David Gallup. When a lumbering freight train eased its way through, you could be stuck at the crossing for a half hour, or hightail it to the other end of town to the solitary bridge over the tracks. The Navajo Nation was the principal tribe in this heart of Indian country. The experience of shooting in New Mexico enlightened me to the fact that you can't just drive around the Navajo Nation lands and, quote, see what's going on. Tribal land is not only sacred, it's private. Some Navajo sites are open to non-Navajo visitors, but otherwise outsiders are not welcome without a guide. One site I visited with Ida was the Canyon de Chelly National Monument, which is managed in conjunction with the Federal Park Service. The monument is unique that it represents an area that has been continuously inhabited for some 5,000 years. Most places with ancient ruins are now barren, with no inhabitants for miles around. In Canyon de Chelly and other monuments on tribal land, Navajo families still live on the land. At the bottom of the canyon, dwellings hundreds of years old would remain frozen in time, while up on the mesa, the ancestors' modern-day Navajo relatives resided in trailer homes. Life in the beautiful canyon wasn't entirely bucolic. In 1864, Colonel Kit Carson and the Federal Army forced the Navajo into the last stand at the end of the Box Canyon. After a long winter, the Navajo surrendered, ending the last major engagement between their tribe and the feds. In discussions with our Navajo hosts, who were most gracious, you couldn't escape the conversation about what had happened before any of us was around and the horrible way the Native Americans were treated. Most conversations about the topic usually ended with non-natives looking down at the ground, nodding and saying, "Yeah, boy, you guys really got screwed." It was ironic that the Navajo, given their size and successful implementation of gas and oil extraction, not to mention casinos on their sovereign land, were considered the rich tribe. In the week that we were shuttled around to various locations, I sure as hell didn't meet anyone who was rich. To illustrate the point, a Native American crew member, hired to drive one of the actor's campers, got a little too excited about the weekly paycheck and took off to party with friends in the camper. It took some back-channel searching, but the woman was eventually located. When she was asked what happened, her excuse was as shocking as it was simple. She had never seen that much money before. The first half of the shoot was in and around the city of Gallup, but the later part was on actual tribal lands. Knowing this, I asked the producers to reach out to the Navajo location guides to see if they could arrange for a holy man to come and bless our production. To my great delight, the producers agreed, and a blessing was arranged. The morning of the first day shooting on Navajo land was shockingly cold, hovering right around 11 degrees. Our van steered into a nearby Conoco gas station. This was the rendezvous point to pick up our shaman, who was also the location guide's uncle. This small, smiling man hopped in our van, and we rode to the location, mostly in shivery silence. At the base camp, we gathered the crew around in a large circle, and the shaman did his thing, blessing the four directions and passing around a modern-day peace pipe containing a sage-like herb. I took a hit and coughed my brains out, but I was honored to participate in this ancient ritual. I asked the holy man if he could do something about the cold. He said it was already taken care of, and the crew shared a good laugh, their billowing breath backlit by the orange-tinted morning sun. Mercifully, each day got warmer for the next 3 days we filmed at that location, so it seemed our guide did something right. Shooting the actual film was mostly uneventful. I enjoyed working with a diverse cast, from James Freshville to Judge Reinhold to Annabeth Gish. We were all trying to make the best out of an oddball situation. I use that term because the setup of this project was something out of an international financier's textbook. The main creative types involved, the writer, composer, producer, and director, were English in nationality, yet were all based in the United States. The rest of the crew came from Ottawa, Canada, yet we filmed